This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series.
Okay, folks, I think we have all of the beer sorted out now, so we can get on with our final reader of the evening. For those of you who are going to be listening on the podcast sometime in the future, Ross Clark is a graduate of Clarion West, so clearly a fabulous writer person. For us here in Bristol, of course, she's much better known as part of our dynamic duo of editors. Which one is Bruce and which one is Dick, I'm not entirely sure, but they make a magnificent team together.
She's Dick, I'm a...
All right, now I've got the fighting issue. I'm not entirely sure what she's going to read to us tonight, but I'm very much looking forward to it. Can we have a warm welcome, please, for Ross Clark?
I don't do this. I get anxious and I forget simple things like how to breathe, how to stand up, much less read words off a page, so bear with me and hopefully somebody will scoop me up again if I do disintegrate halfway through. This is a total coincidence, I promise. I'm also reading the second chapter from my novel in progress. I'm actually only reading the first half of it, so hopefully it's short and it won't drag on because it's not nearly as action-packed or thrilling as Scott's, and there's no lost trousers at all. A bit disappointing. The novel's called Luminous, and the first chapter actually is quite action-packed, but it doesn't lead to a satisfying conclusion. It leaves you on a terrible cliffhanger, and because the novel is not published and I don't have a date for it, I thought it would just be simply too cool. Second chapter is where we are introduced to the second of the protagonists, a guy called Jake Heston. So this is the first time we've met him, hopefully. We won't suffer from the lack of knowing what's gone before. The clang of the doorbell was the last thing Jake needed or wanted to hear. A hammer blow on his tightly strung nerves. The glass vial he was holding shattered in his hand. Beads of sweat bloomed along his hairline and thin brown fluid from the vial covered the front of his good jacket and dripped from his fingers onto the carpet where it pooled around the red and gold shards of glass. Hand-blown, Venetian. A gift from a well-travelled friend, much beloved. The smell, oh lord, the smell, shit! He tore the jacket off and rushed to the sink in the corner of the room, treading broken glass under his brown brogues as he went. It had been his mother's room. The dove-grey carpet, one of her many prides and joys, had suffered plenty of indignations before today at Jake's oft-trembling hands. She'd died almost a year ago. The anniversary of her death was 9 days off, which may have made some contribution to the state of his mind, but he would never have admitted to it, even under torture. He took perverse pleasure in destroying her precious carpet, ruining the sanctified air of her bedchamber with his mucky daubings and suspect potions. She'd hated everything about him that was an expression of himself, his inner self, the self that had nothing but to do with his mother and owed her nothing. He licked the bitter liquid from his fingers before pouring water over them. He hoped it would be enough to take the edge off. He'd spent the whole morning walking the streets of Mistral, fighting off the urge to return to the house and open that vial, or one of the 100-odd others that decorated the shelves around him. He was supposed to put all that behind him as he crossed the suspension bridge, left this incomplete, scribbled version of himself stranded in midair, while he, Jacob Heston, responsible man of medicine, walked on to his appointment at the hospital. A battle had been fought and lost. And won, if he happened to value a scribbled, broken man, always straining against the bonds of life, kicking against expectation. The bell chimed again. Jake hurled himself from the room, drying his hands on his shirt front. His eye lit on one of his painter's smocks, slung across the landing balustrade, and he pulled it on. Whoever it was, let them know that they were interrupting important work. He was making a name for himself, damn it, even if it wasn't yet a name his neighbours knew or could know. The responsible man of medicine whimpered at the thought of the neighbours knowing. He half tripped and almost fell down the stairs. In the hallway he hesitated. A flurry of letters and circulars and one slim white package lay on the generous doormat. He scooped them all up and deposited them on the sideboard on top of the piles already languishing there. In theory there were three separate piles, one for Jake, one for his lodger, Jamil, and one, the largest, for people who did not currently live, and in many cases never had lived, at 16 Border Lane. Some of the letters were out of place, some of them were out of time, all of them were ignored. The piles had slithered together uncomfortably despite Jamil's attempts to fashion bulwarks out of candlesticks and a basket of hats and gloves, and this fresh addition caused a good section of the teetering mass to drop down behind the sideboard. The missives vanished into the forgotten realm of discarded boots, shoes, dust, woodlice. I should do something about that, Jake thought reflexively, but the door had to be answered. Through the stained glass panel, he could make out two shapes on the front porch. It wasn't Jamil then, keyless, irritating. It wasn't the milkman or the paperboy or the grocer's boy or Mrs. Bendit from number 14 come to peer at the mess and inquire after his health. Jake's heart set up a syncopated rhythm. He considered turning and retreating to his studio, but the hall light was on and the sky outside was cast over with January gloom. Chances were they could see him too. Oh, for heaven's sakes, he cried, unlatching the door and throwing it wide with a great burst of effort, almost knocking himself over. A rush of cold air came in, and behind it stood two police persons. Their boots were crusted with snow. The larger one was stamping his feet and clapping his hands together. His nose, protruding between low, bushy eyebrows and an impressive beard, was bright red. The smaller one, definitely of surprisingly female, glared at Jake. When the big one spoke, his words were visible in the air. Mr. Heston? Jake scrabbled for a response. Had someone uncovered his identity? It wasn't, would not be, all that surprising. Had only been a matter of time, really. Yes, it was past time. He'd decided that only this morning, hadn't he? Past time for someone to put two and two together and come up with Jake. He hadn't been as careful as all that, especially since the breakdown. And who could expect it? A pang in his gut. Who has betrayed me? Greta? Destine? Was followed by a wave of peculiar relief. Oh Lord, there was still the broken bottle on the studio floor, on his mother's bedroom floor, and all of its fellows on the walls, and here were two police folk on his very own porch. Are you all right, Mr. Heston? Asked the policeman. His face has become an interesting colour, remarked the woman from the side of her mouth. Curiosity softened the glare. The policeman ignored her. He flashed his badge at Jake. Detective Inspector Terence Mean, he said, and this is my assistant, Miss Bidell. May we come in, Mr. Heston? We won't take too much of your time, but it's a matter of some importance. That is, it might be. And it's a little chilly out here, you know, and a bit, he glanced around him. Jake did know. He didn't have the benefit of a coat, after all, and the porch, well, yes, the porch was disconcerting. It wasn't really Jake's fault, he reminded himself. Number 16 was the last house at the bottom of the cul-de-sac, the house in whose once extensive grounds the rest of the street was built. It was larger than the others and set well back from the road behind a monstrous laurel hedge that blocked out the new streetlights, at least from ground level. The path snaked up to the front door in a sinuous curve that revealed, as one approached the house, a pair of tall black guardian statues. A normal such villa might have had a pair of stone dogs or lions, badly carved, but Jake's house lacked these, and Greta had taken it on herself to remedy the oversight. Black granite horse bodies, elongated necks that morphed into the cruel lion heads of falcons, wings whose feathers ends in barbed metal tips, shimmering purple and orange in the hard light. The junction between the stone and the metal was indiscernible, so you couldn't mistake them for anything other than Greta's work. Jake had it on the good authority of all the neighbours and tradesmen that the statues were geet-skeery beggars. Their hollow eyes were bent towards the doorstep. They were worth a small but rapidly increasing fortune. Jake stopped himself from reaching out to caress a frozen flank, instead taking a step back and ushering his visitors across the threshold. They declined to remove their coats and insisted on carrying their hats with them. Jake led them into the sitting room. The man, D.I. Mean, put his bulk on the Chesterfield. A small cloud of dust and dog hair rose around him. The woman, Bidell, stood by the empty fireplace. She ran a gloved finger along the mantel, tracing a line around the little china figurines and silver-framed photographs. Jake stood in the centre of the rug. He shifted from one foot to the other and tried to hide his trembling. The ringing in his nerves had quieted somewhat, but he was only waiting for the hammer to fall again. An image flashed across his mind's eye of himself launching his thin frame black back up the stairs, throwing the studio door wide and yelling, "This is who I really am! Here it is!" followed by maniacal laughter and the cold snap of closing handcuffs. It would all be over, fair cop, Gov. "If there's one thing you can be relied on to do, Jake Heston," came his mother's voice, "it's nothing." He sighed. Bidell moved to the corner of the other sofa and plucked quizzically at the throw that covered it. Without showing any emotion, she looked beneath the edge of the throw and then went back to her position by the fireplace. Mean watched her until she came to rest. Their eyes met briefly before she returned her gaze to the knick-knacks and the trail she'd made in the dust. Mean twitched his trousers up a little at the knee, revealing knitted navy socks above his shining boots. A chunk of ice fell onto the floor and refused to melt. Mean looked up at Jake. Jake looked down at Mean. His pulse still throbbed in jazz time. It pounded in his throat, raced around his ribcage and jived in his temples. For a second he wished his mother was there. But no, not his mother. Some kindly person, a kindly old housekeeper who would bustle in, set everyone at ease, bring tea and cake and give Jake time to muster himself, gather some courage. But there was nobody. The dog whose grey hairs clung sadly to Mean's solid thighs was 3 months dead. Jameel was out. Jameel was always out, and it was supposed to be his job to clean the house in lieu of the rent. That was the arrangement. My lodger's meant to clean, he said, still hopping from foot to foot, but he's too beautiful. Oh, Lord, I mean, his name's Jameel, and he says he's too beautiful for housework, but actually he's just terribly lazy. I'm afraid, you see, it's that the housekeeper quit when my mother died. She was quite old anyway, the housekeeper, that is, not my mother. She was only 62, but she had cancer, though she always claimed she was dying of a broken heart on account of the houses, you see. He looked hopefully at me. Mr. Heston, we're here to talk to you about... Jake felt nauseous. He shouldn't have mentioned Jameel. Jameel, Jake knew, but had not really considered in full, did not have all his papers in order. Like so many people, he'd fled from the echelons, crossed three borders and taken refuge in Mistral. But the once liberal city-state was under a darkening shadow that had nothing to do with the winter. Forces that had once seemed safely far away, thrillingly exotic even, devils Greta had used to impress and frighten them, were closing in, could not be doubted any longer. Jameel was young and had used his freedom, if not wisely, then, well, not too well either, if truth be told, but with great enthusiasm. It was impossible to imagine Jameel flourishing in the tender care of the Mistral Metropolitan Police, and less still if he was forced back to the land of his fathers. In the corner of his eye, Jake could see Bydell turning a China shepherdess over in her slender white hands. When had she removed her gloves? He didn't want her touching the statuette, but he kept his eyes locked on Means. Them things outside. Those is Deline's, aren't they? You close with Miss Deline? What? Jake thumped down onto the sofa, facing the detective. He ran his fingers through his hair. He pressed his hands between his legs and squeezed, hoping to control them. But the twitch transferred itself to his legs. His right foot drummed against the floor. What? He said again. Greta Deline, said Bydell, finally facing him, has gone missing, as I suspect you already know. She took a handkerchief from her pocket, looked at her dirty hands, and then blew her nose. Mean took over. Have you heard from her, Mr. Heston? Has she been here? Do you know of her whereabouts? No, said Jake. No, I haven't seen her for a while. We are close, as you say, after a fashion, but we don't always see one another, sometimes not for months. Greta still travels a lot, despite, you know, everything. Bydell joined us from the Central Kingdoms because she has expertise in just that area. She's been investigating the thefts of what the echelons like to call vitiating factors. When did you last see Miss Deline? It wasn't the thefts that bothered her, you know. Even the impounding wasn't really the issue. It was the destruction, the defacement. When the mob pulled down Sacred Cow in Jebras, that really got to her. She was so... It's not like her, you understand, to get upset. Going off without telling anyone. Now that is exactly like Greta. Always up to turf for a box of dried frogs, or visiting a crystal healer in Lyaben, or meeting a promising young artist in Nova Vera. He spoke with venom. Mean's response was cautious. It's your belief, then, that she has gone somewhere of her own wish, so to say? Well, of course. You don't really think... Could the echelons already? Mean shook his head. Not here. Not yet. At least we don't think so. He looked to Bydell for corroboration, and she nodded. Mean shook his beard. The ice in it had finally melted and water droplets flew out. He wiped his face with his damp woolen sleeve. Jake jumped up. She was at the Henderson's party the week before last. No way, she wasn't. She should have been there, but she didn't come in the end. I don't know why not. She was definitely at the New Year's ball at the theatre because she turned up with all these snake umbrellas and everyone was dancing with them. Nearly lost an eye several occasions. I can't believe anything awful has happened to Greta. Even if she has been rather peculiar, more peculiar, lately. Not that I've seen her, really very lately. New Year would be the last time. But a few weeks ago, before Christmas, that is, listen, I'll get you a towel, and I'll put the kettle on and light the fire, and I'm so sorry, but as you can see, I'm rather on my own with the whatevers, the household whatevers. He fled the room. Greta, missing. And the police knew they'd been close. How on earth? Jake wished it was true that they were still close, as they briefly had been, as he'd imagined they always would be. they'd once clicked together like two halves of a clasp.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.